Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
1,100 miles, nearly a million swings of the paddle, 40 days on the water. But those statistics, as impressive as they are, still don't capture the epic quality of Brian Kastner's quest. He was following the path of Scottish explorer Alexander Mackenzie and Indian chief Gawena deep into the northern part of this country, and in the travel, learning about the fragility of our wilderness and his own determination and resilience. Brian writes of this land that Mackenzie would traverse. This river cleaved lands unknown and largely unclaimed by Europeans, and the borders were not yet enforced in any meaningful way. That's what it was like then. As Brian joins us, I think we'd like to hear about your epic wilderness quest. Have you retreated into the wilderness, maybe on a portage and paddle trip into the boundary waters or a long hiking trip into the mountains, and returned knowing something new about yourself? I want to hear about your epic journey into the wilderness. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR. If you happen to have some photos of that epic journey, hey, feel free to tweet them in. It's at @CarrieNPR. Brian Kastner was a bomb disposal expert in the Iraq War. He's a nonfiction writer. And his newest book is titled Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. And he's with us from Buffalo. Brian, welcome. Good to talk to you again. How are you?
Yes, it's great to talk to you again, Carrie. Thank you.
I was thinking, because I know you're a reader, that you understand this idea of what the quest is in literature. And I wondered if, you know, some of the elements of those classic quests fit into where you went and what you did and whether you were thinking about that.
Yeah, I think so. I have to admit, I'm often drawn to the ambiguous quest or the ambiguous ending, where you're searching for something, and when you get it, it's not quite what you had in mind, or it doesn't quite fit the bill. And so, yeah, I wrote a book titled Disappointment River, because Mackenzie and I both traveled that enormous river, and I have a hard time explaining or conveying in both words and photos exactly how huge this river is. And I guess we both found what we were looking for at the end, but it wasn't quite what he had in mind. You know, and for myself, you know, I had a finish line for my marathon. It was Garry Island, which Mackenzie called Whale Island, which is way out into the Arctic Ocean. And when we made it there, you know, I don't know. I guess I proved something, that it is really more about the journey than the destination, because it's a mud mound, you know, out in the ocean with a little bit of grass and a whole bunch of dried wood. Is like all the driftwood in the world. It's like a magnet for the stuff out there. And when we're there, I was cold and wet and hungry and ready to go home.
So you finally get there, and it's not. So I've ended my quest. This is the ultimate moment of my quest, and it's a muddy island with a bunch of wood. And let's just get going.
Yeah, I had this feeling. So I went walking along the beach, and there really is nothing between you and the North Pole out there. So there's just screaming north wind, and I see bear tracks. I saw bear tracks all over the river, grizzly and black and brown. And there's these bear tracks walking on the beach, and I followed them for a little while. And I thought, I worked so hard to get here, and this bear was born here. And I wonder if he realizes that he's born in exactly the place I tried so hard to get to.
That's excellent. Greg says on Twitter, endured difficult conditions and depended on myself and my companions to get through it. Now I know better what I'm capable of doing, bringing pride and confidence. I think that's also one of the, of course, the most interesting questions of a quest is this will not end the way I think it will. I think most people go into a quest understanding that. And what I need to bring to addressing the uncertainty of that is the thing I'm going to learn a lot about myself. Right? I mean, you went through that.
I did. Like you mentioned, I was a bomb technician in Iraq. I've been through crucibles before, the crucible of that explosive ordnance disposal school. I've done the combat tours. And yet somehow at the age of 38, I still felt like I had something left to prove. And it's a really ambiguous feeling. Like, I had never been on a long wilderness trip like this. And I guess I can say fortunately that by the time I was done, I did feel like I have nothing left to prove. And maybe most importantly, nothing left to prove to myself. You know, I knew that I could survive all these things. We had a particular moment on the river where we were windbound. The waves were so high and the wind was so bad, we could make no more progress. And we were stuck for days. And it was really the low point of the trip. But we managed to get back on the water. The wind had barely subsided. We crossed the river. We knew that there would be grizzly bears on our side of the river. We had to get to the other side. And when we did that, there was like a moment of zen where we thought, you know what, we're just going to keep trying. The river is going to let us go or not go. And we're just going to make progress. And you enter the state where, you know, what will happen will happen.
Yeah.
But you know that you've given it everything that you can.
So what I was thinking about as I was reading about your trip was all the maps, you're trying to apply a lot of certainty to a vastly uncertain thing. And that's human nature. I mean, that's who we are, right? You want to lay out the maps and go, and on this day I'll be here, and this is what the water's going to be like. But then it sounds like early on you succumb to the idea that there is no certainty here. And that's part of the key part of the quest. And you embrace that.
Yeah, you give up a little bit of control you just make as many miles as you can a day. And whether it's thunderstorms or heat or cold or bugs or, snow by the end, it was July, but it was snowing on us, that you just – yeah, you can only plan so much. I think I did do a good job in planning my gear. My tent never ripped to shreds, and I ended up using just about every piece of gear I brought, including an old pair of fireman's boots, to walk in the silt and the muck of the Delta at the end.
Allison just tweeted me the most beautiful photograph from the Boundary Waters, and she says, "My time in the BWCA wilderness taught me how to be a morning person." If you've just gotten in on the show, Brian Kastner is with us. We're talking about his new book, Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage. And it was an epic adventure, an epic quest. And I'm asking you this morning as you tune into this discussion, whether you've been on one of those yourself. I'm not so much interested in where you went, although that's interesting. I want to know what you learned about yourself at the end of the journey. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and you can tweet me your photo or your story at Carrie NPR to Prescott in Duluth. Hi, I'm so glad you called. It sounds like you go up into the Boundary Waters a lot, yes?
I do indeed, yeah, Prescott in Duluth. And my experience was mainly both as a camper and a wilderness guide for YMCA Camp Minogen up in the Boundary Waters. And we primarily focus on high adventure trips for kids, teenagers, between the ages, I think it's 12 to about 18 or 19,
mm-hmm.
and going to the Boundary Waters, northern Canada, on trips ranging from 8 days to 40-plus days on trail.
Wow.
And the amazing thing to me is to have gone through that experience as a teenager and then also bringing teenagers through something like that. I always talk about sort of a portage being an analogy for life. I mean, you see kids going through some really, really tough stuff, and they really get broken down to their core in a positive way, not actually broken down. But, you know, if you can do a really tough portage and carry a canoe that you never thought you could, it sort of puts your homework assignments in perspective, you know?
for sure.
It's a great way to, you know, get these kids to unplug, to learn how to work with each other, to learn sort of what they're made of, and they always come out so much better for it.
I'm interested in, Prescott, what's the day, you know, what day on the trip do you start to see the change happen? I mean, are you usually 6 days in, or does it take longer?
It depends on the trip, and it depends on the kids. You know, if they have some experience, it's a little bit longer. But, you know, I did a lot of trips with kids that had never been in the wilderness. And usually about day three or four, you know, first day is fine. The packs are their heaviest, so sometimes that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
But you get a couple days into it, and they realize, man, we got to work together if we're going to get out of here. And that's, we go through something that I call forming, storming, norming, performing.
Uh-huh.
So you form the group, they storm, they realize the challenges, the things that some kids can do better than others. Norming is working through those challenges, and then after that's all sorted out, then you really start to get going as a group. And so that process, that storming process, I found is like day three, day four, and you might have some breakdowns on the trail, but you work through them, and after you reflect on the whole trip, after it's all said and done, they all have nothing but positive things to say about it,
you know,
if they're totally breaking down on trail.
I'll bet that arc sounds somewhat familiar, Brian, right? All this optimism that you launch with and then the days in and what it's like.
That's right. And actually, as he's talking, I'm thinking about one of my paddle mates. So I didn't do this trip alone. I had four friends and they each did a segment with me. Nobody else could take a whole summer off to journey with me. And one of those guys was Jeremy Howard Beck. So my first book, The Long Walk, was turned into an opera. And Jeremy was the composer of that opera. So that's how we met. And he, he's a New York kid. And had camped in a tent a single time, had never pooped in the woods. I didn't know that until we were out on the trip. But I'll tell you what, at the end of 2 weeks, Jeremy was a changed man. The first night, I yelled, it was the middle of a thunderstorm, and I yelled, hey, get the sleeping bags and the stuff sacks. And he asked, what's a stuff sack? And by the last night, or by the last day, we have huge waves. And that we're plowing through, and he is absolutely fearless and was, you know, a totally changed man by the end.
I have to tell you, I loved Jeremy. I mean, it's great to go out into this adventure with a lot of experience, but his learning curve and his talk about resilience, Brian. I mean, right? He could have, I don't know, could he have called it quits? I guess he would have had to find his way back on his own, but I mean, his determination was pretty inspiring.
Yes, I am very proud of Jeremy, and he's a good sport. He's the butt of a few jokes in the book, but he approved them, and I can say it's nonfiction. It's all true. But he is, yeah. I was really proud because he went into a really unknown situation, he could not have walked home. Jeremy and I spent our most time alone. We went 10 days without seeing another person, so that was our longest stretch that I took without meeting anyone else. And yeah, I was just really proud of him by the end. He was a new person.
Karen tweeted me a photo of a couple of wolves. She says, I was on a solo two-night canoe trip in 2011, so by herself. She says, on Lake Luneta in the BWCA. And I looked up and saw these two wolves staring at me. We spent 4 or 5 minutes looking at each other. Shazam, those moments transformed me. I returned, divorced my husband, changed my life. I retweeted the photo of the wolves. To the phones to Josh in Asheville, North Carolina. Josh, boy, there's some great adventuring in North Carolina where you live.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. I actually came down here for a wilderness backpacking program for alcohol addiction.
Mm.
Try to hike yourself sober. And I came down here and I did that. Didn't get completely sober. What I ended up doing sort of as a last ditch effort after 10 different treatments is I through hiked the Pacific Crest Trail
mm-hmm.
with some of my buddies, and we finished the trail. We got to Canada, and I got drunk again in Seattle, and we took one more weekend out onto the Olympic coast. And there was just a moment out in the wilderness, out in the national park at sunset where I realized that the rest of my life could be, you know, all of these epic wilderness adventures that I'd grown up doing and cherishing, and that the drinking just couldn't be a part of my life if I wanted to continue to experience these moments. And I've been sober ever since then. It's the first time I've been sober this long since I started trying, and I definitely credit the wilderness with a large part of that success.
Yeah, so have you gone on a lot of wilderness trips since then, minus the alcohol,
of course? Yeah, I've done a bunch. in the Asheville area, like Smoky Mountains National Park, Congaree National Park. I grew up guiding backpacking and canoe trips for the Center for Outdoor Adventure at the University of Minnesota.
I see.
So it's definitely a place where that brings me a lot of peace. I feel a lot safer, and I'm able sort of to focus on my priorities and understand how I want to live my life.
Josh, really good to have the call. Glad you were listening in Asheville. Brian, the introspection, I having read the book here, I know so much of this is tactical and strategy, and it isn't like you're just drifting along and not thinking about anything. But there were moments when you were thinking about what your experience in Iraq and the kind of dad you are to your son, all of that, right? You had time for that.
Of course. Yeah. And as with your last caller, I was thinking that, the first men who hiked through the Appalachian Trail said that they were walking off the war. And in my own experience as a veteran, after I got back from Iraq, one of the I had a lot of struggles that, and I've written about them. But it was a particular whitewater trip through the Royal Gorge on the Arkansas River in Colorado that I think I had a moment. Like your caller was saying, like sitting out on the coast where you it does snap you back. And I think you get a good balance. I think one of the things about one of these trips is it really does bring you in the moment when you're out on the water and the waves are high and the wind is bad and it's cold and sleet. You can't think about anything else. You have to be totally present, zen-like a Buddhist monk there. But then when you have time on the shore, like you say, I would write for about an hour every night, nights in finger quotes, by the way, because the sun doesn't go down. So I would be able to stay up whatever hour and think through what kind of dad am I and, why am I here? I guess some of the most basic questions, right? And, the difference, though, on this kind of wilderness trip today, as opposed to Mackenzie or as opposed to even not that long ago, I had a device with me called a DeLorme InReach. And it's both a GPS and a texting system through the satellite. So I'm in the middle of nowhere and my kids are texting me. We're big hockey fans. And it's like, did you see the big Sabres trade, that just happened? And well, no, kiddo, I didn't, and it was good for them. And for me, I guess it was good. But it's also lonesome and you get a bit homesick and it does help you appreciate, I can go home and stay home and not. I mean, Shackleton, the great Antarctic explorer, he called it the lure of little voices. Uh-huh. And I understand that for sure. And, a trip like this, I was able to quiet them for quite a bit.
I was just going to say, did you start to say I can go home and stay home and that's it? Or are you starting to feel the restlessness again to do something like this?
Yeah, I always felt the wanderlust for so long. And when I would get back from a trip, the wanderlust would just come back again. And I thought it was just like intrinsic to my personality or something. It's why one reason I kept returning to war and a number of other things. But finally, at the end of this one, I felt like this itch has been scratched for the longest in my own life, I guess, so far. I hope it stays scratched for a little while longer.
I love how we can sense that you're not really in control of that. Right? When it hits, and you're going to have to give in to that, it sounds like.
Well, I don't know. I'm not the only one that feels that way. I think Tolkien wrote this great line, "Not all who wander are lost." And I do think about that. The benefit now is my kids are old enough that they can wander with me and my wife, too.
Call here from Abby in Minneapolis. Abby, where were you dog sledding? I can't wait to hear about this.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was on the 2007 expedition with Will Steger to Baffin Island.
Wow.
Which is north of the Arctic Circle. Yeah, it was a once in a lifetime, needless to say. And I just wanted to share that for me, wilderness has been one of the most powerful experiential teachers and has taught me more about humility, about as much about humility as motherhood has. And that in that, really realizing that, there's no room for bravado. If you're only focusing on yourself, like your team will suffer. Mm-hmm. And if you're only focusing on your team, which for me, growing up in as like a female, caretaker, I really had to take care of myself. And that was a very powerful lesson that I would say continues into my work today, that I need to prioritize my own well-being as much as I am prioritizing the well-being of my, you know, teammates in whatever setting that might be.
That's a powerful insight. Will, by the way, Steger is out on another adventure on his own, isn't he?
Speaking of the itch that you just can't quite scratch.
Yeah, I know.
I think he'll be doing it to the very end of his days, which is very, very inspiring.
Really good to have your call. Thanks so much. Brian, one of the things that comes through, I think, in your memoir is something that Abby spoke to, which is the romanticism and that bravado, it's me against nature, and that gets stripped away pretty quick on the kind of trip you did.
Yeah, it did not take long at all. And I think that's a really important lesson that I learned that, you know, I'm afraid that Thoreau has infected us Americans with this romance of the wilderness. And yet, you know, he sent out his laundry and, you know, Walton Pond wasn't that far outside of town. And I think when you take a trip like this or, you know, above the Arctic Circle, wherever you're going, you realize that we have this view of nature that I'm afraid comes from our national parks, which are aesthetically beautiful, but we've set them aside because of that, and we've killed everything in those parks that might eat us, in large extent. And so we go to a set camping ground and we look at how beautiful this area is or whatever else. And we think we're in wilderness and we're not. And wilderness is all those in-between places. There's lots of the Mackenzie River Valley or, I don't know, lots of places, I'm sure, in the Boundary Waters as well, that are just nothing but black spruce and water and days upon days. And the monotony is as much of the challenge as anything else out there. It's a mental challenge.
You have some really great descriptions of portaging, what it was like for you and what it was like for Alexander Mackenzie. And I know this is something that is familiar to a lot of people in our region because they go up to the BWCA and portage. You describe what Mackenzie, the 19th century explorer or 18th century? 19th.
18th century. The trip that I followed, he did in 1789, actually while George Washington was being inaugurated.
So he's got these descriptions of portaging, and you describe what that was like for him as an infamous 9-mile climb of backbreaking root steps and slick rock. With the kind of gear that he had accessible back in 1789, tell me a little bit about the challenge of following his trail and specifically the portaging that you had to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, that description is of Grand Portage, obviously, which is now Minnesota. And at the time, like you said at the top of the show, it was a no man's land where it was all these contradictory claims and what country it would be and what country had claimed it were all different. So the birch bark canoes that Mackenzie and his voyagers and his indigenous guides were in, they're really an amazing piece of technology. It's like if you needed a vehicle to go through the wilderness of North America on the rivers, you know, the best possible vehicle would be this canoe, and all of the materials to make the canoe grow along the river. So it's the birch bark, it's the spruce root, it's the cedar and everything else. And so I mean, these canoes were enormous. They were, you know, some were 20 feet long, some were more, 36 feet long, but they would only weigh a couple hundred pounds. And so two or four people could carry them. I guess a couple hundred pounds is better than is better than 1,000, you know, but they were. When the voyagers would do this portaging, they didn't walk, they ran, and they put the goods on a tump line on their forehead, and all of the goods were divided into 90-pound pieces, you know, wrapped up in sailcloth, and they would carry two at a time, so 180 pounds off their forehead, and it was like a dog's canter as they would run back and forth. And then some people were in charge of the canoe and some people were in charge of the goods. And so the people in charge of the goods would actually run the portage on average 5 times back and forth.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And so anything that I did, you know, dragging a kayak up around the Slave River or something was minuscule in compared to what they did. Because the Mackenzie River itself, what's now known as the Mackenzie, the indigenous nations up there know it as still as the Detcho. They, you know, it's so large. It's much more like the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Some places you can't see the other side. And so it is a lots of current, and it's just like hop on the highway and it's going to, you know, take you on an express trip to the Arctic.
How heavy was the gear that you were portaging at that point?
We had filled the canoe to the brim. We were in an 18.5-foot sea clipper, it's called, which was, you know, we wanted to be long for the waves. So I guess I never actually – I never measured – I didn't add up the poundage on that. Maybe I should have, but it would take a couple trips.
But yeah, I mean, so you take an 18-foot canoe filled to the brim and you're carrying
right.
that over. I mean, was the topography – I know it's changed because, as noted at the beginning, there are now borders and, you know, some of this wilderness has been tamed. But how similar would you say the topography was to what Mackenzie was encountering in certain places?
Oh, I mean, the land hasn't changed. And actually, the amount of indigenous settlement hasn't really changed either. They estimate about 10,000 people lived in that valley when he took his trip, and that's about how many people live there now.
Wow.
And it's a hard land. The nations up there, some of the elders, you know, still keep to the old traditional lifestyle. They have camps all over, fish in certain places at certain time, hunt moose at certain times. But then the young people, you know, are much more bound to the towns. And it's a desperate. It's not purely desperate. There. I met lots of wonderful people up there, but the poverty and I mean the suicide rate and the alcoholism is. You just can't avoid it when you're up there. It's really quite startling.
Call here from Dan in Scandia. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while and we've got some pretty busy lines here. So thank you.
Well, thanks for taking my call. What a great show. My brother and I have been putting in for a lottery to hunt up at Kodiak Island in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother for 18 years put in for this lottery, and we finally got a permit to hunt a grizzly bear on Kodiak Island. So what we did is we took his son and my son and myself took a rubber raft 26 miles down the Karlik River in Kodiak Island.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible adventure. Wasn't all that fun because it rained and the wind blew a lot. The sun would set about 4 o'clock and come up about 9 the next morning, and you couldn't have a campfire. So it was
wow.
It was pretty challenging that way. What happened though is, you know, you spend your whole hunting career thinking, oh my gosh, the grizzly bear, Kodiak Island, some of the biggest grizzlies in the world. And what happened is we had a sow come into camp with a cub, and we had a 9-foot fly rod leaning against the brush. And when that bear stood up, it was 2 feet higher than the brush. And when you're out in the middle of nowhere and every hair on your body stands up, I mean,
I guess.
Number two on the food chain, and a bear that size could close 50 yards in about 4 seconds and kill everybody.
Wow.
So we are glad she didn't come into camp. However, we were able to hunt Sitka deer with the same permit, and my brother had killed a little Sitka. And we watched this mother and her cub play on the other side of the river. And this sow had grabbed the carcass and ran up a hill that you or I would take an hour to climb. She did in like 5 minutes with a 150-pound deer in her mouth. And I sat all day and watched her and her cub play and eat that carcass. And it just changed. I could never hunt a grizzly again. It was her place. That's where they live. I would just feel blessed that I was able to visit. And I was very humbled. And now I could never shoot a grizz.
Brian, how about the wildlife that you saw?
Yeah, what you know, the river was so large that on the banks we would see tracks from every sort of animal: moose, muskox, wolves, grizzly bears. There was one grizzly bear track that was four times the size of my foot, and so maybe it was one of those 11-foot tall ones that they're not quite as big in the Mackenzie Valley as they are in Sitka, but. You know, so we saw the tracks and we saw the evidence and we saw the scat, but we actually saw very few of the animals themselves. As he was telling his story, I was thinking mostly we were trying to avoid grizzlies. So it was all about, you know, you cook dinner in one place and then get back on the river and paddle another hour. So that way, you know, they can't smell your food. And we had a bear banger with us, which is, I didn't carry a gun.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, so a bear banger is a pen flare. It looks like a pen and it's got like a cocking mechanism and it shoots a shotgun shell that has a flare. And the idea is to scare away, you know, the grizzly bears with the loud noise and the light. And we never had to fire it. But when we got to the very end to Gary Island, we thought we would fire it as a celebration and it didn't work. So I guess it's good that we never had to try to use it for real.
Oh my gosh. Wow, Brian, what an experience. Hey, we're going to close with some, and you might be familiar with this music by Stan Rogers. It's a song called The Northwest Passage. Were you listening to music along the way, or were you really had to be tuned in to your environment?
No, I guess I was tuned in. I was trying to be as present as I could.
Okay. Well, I hope you like this song and the music, and I loved the book, and thanks so much for the time. Good to have
you. Of course,
here.
It was wonderful to talk to you and your guests.
Brian Kastner's book is called Disappointment River, Finding and Losing the Northwest Passage.
Just one time I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea.